Oh gosh, no.
The revolution is live.
I like that. Oh gosh, no. No.
At this point, I just assume it's always live. And that way, you'll never be shocked.
That's safe assumption, honestly. Yeah.
It is. Yet also still scary to realize the things you'll talk about.
Yes, just note everything I said, I assumed they were recording it and it was all live, right?
Pre-show Ralph is like three beer Ralph, but show Ralph is still two beer Ralph.
So yeah, the thing that I was trying to find is, I've been getting, like, I complain about this a lot, where people are like calling or they will to buy BHIS or invest, they'll just call me up out of the blue. And that in and of itself ain't that bad. It's just basically like, not interested, thank you much. Then it escalated to where they just like would call me up. They'd be like, John, we need you on this meeting. I've got the board here and we set up this whole meeting for you. Can you jump on? I'm like, okay. And then I'll jump on and I'll find out it's a pitch to try to buy BHIS. And I'm like, well, that's really, really skeevy. So they escalated it now. We're getting like FedEx envelopes and like these things, and then also certified effing mail, where they will send a letter certified saying, we're interested in buying Black Hills Information Security. So anything we get certified is usually like from the IRS, or it's like a check from the government or something like that. It's a big deal when you get a certified letter. Now all of a sudden we're getting junk certified mail. So just so frustrating.
I don't think
if anyone's buying BHIS, it better be all the employees.
That's well, okay. So B Corp status,
my Bitcoin
on that. Benefit Corp, we are working with the attorneys. So that is a slow process. But yes, we are moving towards Benefit Corp.
Let's go to the bylaws and reference that it says here that we're legally obligated to do cool stuff. So
well, but that's the reason why we should get to the show here in 2 minutes. But there's two reasons why we want to go Benefit Corp, because if we give employees shares of the company and we're standard C Corp, the goal of a C Corp is to make money, to make a profit. And people could come to me and be like, dude, you just sunk a whole bunch of money into an effing comic book that doesn't make us money.
Wait, you're not
a good like COO, and they can basically have me removed.
But it's cool.
Right now, the other reason why we're going, well, that's one, because a benefit corporate, we can make it whatever we want. The other thing is, as soon as we go a benefit corp, BHIS is poison for any investors ever outside.
Yes. Like,
they'll never ever invest
because of
us.
All the bees, because the bees will swarm you.
Bees will swarm you.
They will literally kill
the
you.
Bees.
The whole point of the company is bees. I mean, that's
so
amazing.
The big concern was, we now have to find a new accountant, because the main accountant we were working with in our firm retired. Al was awesome. And now the new guy that's taking it over does nothing but shit on us becoming a benefit corp. He's just like, you guys will never be able to sell out with an attitude like that. And I, like sell you said,
out. You're just sell. Like, okay, yeah. We're moving out. Yeah. See you later.
So dogs of Sit-Up said John was going to sell BHIS for about $350. It's going to be $160.
Loch Ness.
You're going to have to bring a flannel, a license plate.
John.
And you have to run 126 miles in 60 hours.
Oh, is it the Barkley Marathon?
It's the Barkley Marathon.
I freaking love the Barkley Marathon.
So once you've completed the Barkley Marathons, at the very end when you're done, then in that last hour after you've completed, we will have business negotiations about you purchasing Black Hills.
They're just like, I'll trade the whole company for a can of beans. I'm really hungry.
Yeah, you should just do a Kickstarter to sell it, right? And like,
oh,
the top
we
tier.
Should do. Yeah, is that what that was? Did I purchase a share? How does that work?
Speaking of which, before we get rolling, can we kick company. Out the Kickstarter? We do, in fact, have a Kickstarter,
I
not
knew
to buy
we did.
Black Hills Information Security. But our comic Kickstarter went live last week. We met our funding goal in 40 minutes. And if we could kick it up on the screen, Ryan. We met our funding goal in 40 minutes. And we had someone buy the $5,000 tier. Yeah. And for the $5,000 tier, the only thing I know for sure is a marching band will be involved when I hand deliver.
I can't wait. The person who bought it.
Can we get a live stream of it too? Like,
can
Ryan,
I play tuba? I can play tuba. I've never done it before, but how hard could it be?
Sousaphone, so, actually.
Sousaphone. Sorry. No, I'm gonna sit down.
Sousaphone.
John, I heard on Twitter that you were going to personally tell the person who bought it that you know, you're proud of them.
Yeah, no, I am. I'm literally going to
What is it, just John's your dad now?
I'm going to go like to their living room and I'm going to read the first chapter of the comic with a marching band.
That is amazing.
When we do it.
What is this show? Roll the finger.
Let's roll the finger.
On that note.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of Black Hills Information Security Talking About News. I'm back from the hinterlands. I was in Transylvania, by the way, for all the people that I met in Romania. I love you all. Thank you so much for an absolutely wonderful time. And heads up, Norway, I'm coming your way next week. But we've got lots of stories this week, but I want to start out with Kelly, because Kelly has dual back-to-back, I'm not going to say rants. I'm going to say she has opinions about things, and we're going to start out. We've got our wonderful cast of characters that have joined us. Thank you so much to all of you. But Kelly, I really, really, really would like to start on the bipartisan, like our government gets together bipartisan and they come together on a privacy bill. Thank God. I'm sure that everything is wonderful. What's your take on that?
GDPR?
Yeah. Can you bring some hope to the political landscape of America?
No. Oh, goodness. I was with you to that last statement. No, actually, this is super exciting because on February 5th, on Friday, their legislature announced that bicameral and bipartisan support of a new federal privacy law. And I know there's going to be some people out there saying, oh my goodness, do we need another law? But there's some key things I want to highlight in this for everyone. Number one, it is meant to preempt most, if not all, of the state laws. Now, there's a new Maryland law that's a little bit different. I'll get into that on a different time. But some of the key points that we've been talking about in this newscast include data brokers. Do you remember a couple of weeks ago we were talking about your information being sold to data brokers and the new executive order? Well, as part of this new federal privacy law, they're proposing a data broker registry, a universal do not collect my information. Now,
wait, hold on. So if you put, so if you put that in, then all of these data brokers will not be able to tie that information to you as an individual, correct?
I think we're still working out the ins and outs of it, but yeah, the intention is not only do we have a registry of who the data brokers are, but also tying together, if I am registered with the registry, then I have a universal do not collect my data if that's what I intend to share or what I ask for.
Okay.
Because right now, with different privacy laws, and not only at the state level, but also with the global level, we have to opt out in China or Australia or Canada. And it's very difficult for privacy departments to manage this. So one of the cool things that they're proposing this is a global opt-out signal. So if I say I want to opt out of data collection, it applies anywhere. Now, some of you might remember that a couple of years ago, there was another privacy law that was introduced, and that law was a giant flop. This law is substantially different than that a previous law that was proposed. One of the things is there was a lot of conversations around private right of action. And private right of action is fancy legal term saying, do I have the right to sue or the right to take legal action? That was something that was not included in the original privacy bill, but it is included in this proposed privacy bill that came out on Friday. Another interesting thing is nonprofits are included in this bill, but there are carve-outs for small, medium businesses that they may be able to exempt out of some of the requirements. And this, there's a lot going on in this bill, and I haven't had a chance to read it all, but really what I wanted to do today was to say, hey, did you know that there was something more spectacular than the eclipse? It was a proposed federal privacy law.
That was bipartisan.
Bipartisan and bicameral too.
I just searched the draft bill for ChatGPT and I don't see anything in here. So I think it's terrible.
Yeah, it doesn't. It doesn't. Yeah.
Don't rain on my parade. Holy cow.
I mean, even just some of the things you mentioned, the ability to opt out globally. I mean, there's entire companies that are currently set up because the process is such a disaster, right? So that's amazing. But I am curious how this will impact. I am curious to see how it'll impact like California or places that have more restrictive privacy laws.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it going to like undo some of the controls that they've put in place?
Yeah, supersede, but not in a good way.
I don't know.
Aren't laws like firewall policies, right? The more restrictive policy takes top of the line.
Takes precedent. That would be good.
When there's preemption, the federal law takes precedent. But as in terms of California, they have been looking at the California law. And I'm sorry, I don't have all the specifics memorized. I just didn't have enough time today. But I think it's definitely exciting to watch. And I want to pivot to the data broker conversation that we had a couple weeks, maybe 3 weeks ago, about GM collecting information on our cars.
Yeah.
And one of the things, you know, we have a tendency of getting kind of crabby on the show sometimes, but I wanted to share a couple resources for people. One of the resources is GM got a lot of flack for it. So they actually have published information on how to opt out. And believe it or not, they actually disclosed a little bit more of how this is happening. It was all totally within the OnStar program. And a lot of people didn't realize that they had actually opted into OnStar, even though they didn't actually opt into OnStar, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
It was.
Yeah. There was like, you're trying to drive your car, you put it in drive, and it's like, please accept the terms and conditions to continue. You're like, yep, whatever. I need to turn left into this Arby's because I need a chicken.
So, OnStar is the real bad guy here. That's who we need to attack.
Well, they've been the bad guy for a while.
That's so. Like being like, Facebook is fine. It's Meta you have to go after.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay. Same thing.
OnStar is GM.
The man behind the curtain.
OnStar is GM.
Without GM, OnStar wouldn't be a company. I'm just saying that.
I didn't know. Does GM own OnStar?
Yes.
I didn't know that. I thought OnStar was just like its own separate company.
Why do you think they're only in GM service?
Are they only in GMs? Well,
For legal reasons, they probably somehow don't because of some complex bankruptcy bailout that happened in 2008. But yes, they are.
Wade, what car have you seen OnStar in this?
I don't know. I swear I've seen other
Chevy. Is that the same company?
I swear. I don't. Yeah. I know that. I don't know. I drive Japanese cars that go
one point in the room. Japanese that encompass.
Can I add one other thing?
It's not, hey. It's not just GM. It's Chevrolet, Buick, and Cadillac, and GM.
All right. So, Kelly, what else were you going to say? Sorry.
I wanted to add another little tidbit to the conversation I just learned last week. You know how we were talking about LexisNexis and how LexisNexis gathers so much information about us? You can actually get a risk report, a consumer disclosure report from LexisNexis, from the LexisNexis Risk Solutions. And if you haven't done this yet, I highly suggest you do this. What is in that consumer disclosure report is whatever information companies are using to offer you loans or quote insurance rates or offer government assistance, they're going to the LexisNexis to get that information about you. So you can request that consumer disclosure report. And I'm in the process of doing that myself. So if you weren't aware of that resource, definitely go check it out.
Very cool. Very cool.
Next week, when you do that,
you have to give them a bunch of extra data that they're going to sell.
Yeah. I was going to say next week when Kelly gets it, we can go over it live on the news too.
And yeah. Like, all right. Line by line.
So wait, can I get OnStar for my LexisNexis? No.
Can we talk a little bit about the Notepad++ plugin? It's just DLL hijacking.
Let's talk about supply chain stuff because that's not terrifying.
Yeah.
Or unless the plugin was called Well, I don't know. The plugin could have been called click here for free hacks or something.
But this looks to me like it's just a standard DLL hijack attack.
That's all it looked like to me as well. I read through the article and it looks like it's just DLL hijacking. It's not like they've compromised Notepad++ or something like that, as far as I can tell.
Now, I got a question. Does Notepad++ still use the generic update process? I don't know if it still uses GUP.
I don't know about that.
Let me search and look. I have it installed. I'm probably compromised already.
Yeah, already.
Yeah, wait. Let me just check the C2 on your computer. What's your host name?
Mustaches are for cool
kids.
It's not
C2, it's RMM.
I don't know. Right. It says here that the malware was called the Wiki Loader. So with this, I don't.
I guess what I'm trying to get at is how big of a story is this? This doesn't look. I mean, it was actually used. I mean, Notepad++ is used by developers, very highly privileged users, and I think that that's fine. But it's not like the code repository for Notepad++ was compromised. Like, you had to compromise a computer system, then you had to drop this DLL, and then when they restarted Notepad++, it would execute, right?
Yep, yeah, exactly. It's your standard DLL hijack. My take on this is, I think it's good to see public news articles discussing DLL hijacking, because in the pen testing world, we've been using these things for years. Mm-hmm. And in most cases, they remain vulnerable. I mean, there's hijacklibs.net is a cool website, which I'll link, but there's hundreds, possibly thousands of DLLs that are subject to hijacking. Yeah. Most of these are in Windows products, but there's lots of other products listed on hijacklibs as well. So this is like, I think, good to see public execution of these attacks. And now when we do pen tests and we say, hey, this vulnerability is here, your program can be DLL hijacked, that has so much more impact now, because we can say, and here's a campaign that uses it, and that's why you should fix it.
Well, and Corey, this is one of those things that we've been spending some work on in the continuous pen testing side of BHIS, right? Like, I mean, we do research and we use these types of techniques. And I think that there's a couple of reasons why it's good, especially if you can get one that works in Microsoft. Like, I think the one that we've been working on is in Outlook or something. But when we're looking at these, there's a couple of things. One, that persistence mechanism is really, really great. But number two, what a lot of people don't understand is a lot of EDRs, they incorporate something called permissions inherit. So if you trust the primary executable and it's an allowed list executable, you basically then will, in many of the products, trust a lot of the like child dynamic link libraries and child executables that can be invoked by them. Now, one of the things, and I would like to get you all's opinion on this, people are always like, well, if you just do, you know, certificate validation, it should be fine. Code signing certificate validation. You can't, because a huge number of vendors don't actually use code signing certificates. And if they do, they don't use it for their entire library. So they may have it for their initial executable, but a lot of the dynamic link libraries and different things that'll be invoked, if you're looking at like Chrome or a lot of Microsoft products, they don't have that type of security whenever they're looking at inheritance on there. Yeah. So like, especially like Corey and crew, what do you all think? Is that something that organizations need to be more aware of? What can they do to deal with these? Like, Michael, what are your thoughts? Ralph?
I don't remember the last time I built a detection that is looking for certificate signing.
Well, tools.
That's my point. I don't think you can.
Yeah. Well, really? No, you can. You can. Like most EDRs, look at the certificate and you can see the name.
They do, but you can't make it enforced across everything.
You can't.
Because you can't make it. Like even Microsoft and Google, they don't do code signing certificates for every single one of their dynamic link libraries. They just don't.
But you can profile it, right? And try to see where one isn't particularly supposed to run that is supposed to be signed, and try to just find some anomaly based stuff. But mm-hmm. I think it's been a long time since I have tried to do anything with the cert base, just because exactly what you're saying, it is next to impossible, especially when you're running in huge environments where there's going to be a bunch of those.
Well, let's also talk about how many programs.
We got a question for the audience just to help us out. Paul was asking, what does EDR stand for? It stands for Endpoint Detection and Response. I wanted to get that in real quick. Otherwise, this whole conversation is confusing as hell for people that may not know.
So, okay. A couple of things that come to mind, and Michael, feel free to jump in here as well. But number one, I don't know any program that enforces code signing on its DLLs.
Yeah, exactly. You
might have code signing certificates on the binary, but the guess what? The binary can be code signed and I can still DL a hijack, right? That's the whole point. So the other thing, I think my take on this, and I'm curious to hear Michael's, is from an attacker's perspective, it's good and bad at the same time. DL hijacks are good because they execute under the context of an existing process, which means they bypass application allow listing, which is really good. Most of our more secure clients use application allow listing, so I can't just drop in, you know, totally legit.exe and run it. You know, in this case, the process integrity we'd be operating under would be notepad.exe or notepad++.exe or whatever it is. But by the same token, the detections are built around anomalous activity from these process contexts. So like outlook.exe or notepad++.exe, notepad++.exe probably isn't accessing CloudFront or the internet super often. And it probably isn't running PowerShell commands either. So like where the detections come in is you say, okay. Yeah, so that's how you
build
it.
I want to get Wade's take on that, just on that one thing. I want to pause you on that one. Because with our SOC, I've been astounded at how many products out there are actually invoking like PowerShell. They've been invoking Who Am I? They've been invoking all these things.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. And Wade, once again, I want to get your opinion on this. I think that a lot of security professionals, especially in the offensive realm, would be absolutely floored how many offensive techniques are used by legitimate software.
Oh my God. So this is really funny because all last week I was writing detections based on PowerShell and either like invoke any way PowerShell can download a script, right? Now I have to go out there and see everyone downloading stuff with PowerShell and try to create this huge whitelist based on that. And then also using a couple other like non-op type stuff. The amount of PowerShell that's used in a network is just in an advanced network, I'll say it that, is really hard to at least pin down. A lot of the times I'm looking for almost user-based. I try to tune out system, which is a big hole right there. But if you can't even regulate traffic through system and user, or a lot of the EDRs don't even do command line, you have to look at content scripts, that type of stuff. It is such a hassle with anything PowerShell. It takes days and weeks to really hammer it down. What have you guys seen as a company? How do they lock down PowerShell? Like if a company is pushing updates and using it great, like, is there a way? Like, I know Russia just got rid of PowerShell because they don't have Microsoft anymore. But I don't know if you guys are hearing that news. Russia isn't allowed. Microsoft's closing down in Russia.
They're definitely.
Way to drop in a news article in the discussion of another news article.
I know. That one was
now more secure than the United States.
Newscast I had to run. I'm sorry when everybody was gone. But how would you recommend locking down PowerShell?
So really, whenever you're looking at it, and Wade, this is something we've had conversations about. You don't ever look for that one execution on that one alert when you're looking at trying to detect an attack. You've got to look at like rule-based alerting, right? That's not just, okay, we've executed PowerShell. Are we executing PowerShell and are we accessing net commands? Are we running PowerShell and then spawning cmd.exe? Is it connecting out to the internet? You have to look in totality of what that system is doing. And one of the things I teach in my class and one of the things that we've been working on in our SOC is really trying to differentiate between, okay, this process is spawning PowerShell and it does it again and again and again and again every hour or whatever. Okay, that's a tuning opportunity, right? If all of a sudden you have that particular system is exhibiting multiple different alerts, then that becomes something that you have to be more interested in. And if it's making outbound network connections, it's time to start freaking the F out. Right? You can't just look at this as a standard alert of what's being done on that computer, but you got to say, what is the totality of the alerts? When you're also looking at PowerShell, something like PowerShell V1 doesn't have logging. We've seen attackers upload that, use that. We saw that last week. So you're seeing those types of things showing up as well. But for our advanced continuous pen testing customers, like they're locking that stuff down, right? Like trying to lock users out as much as they can. And I wanted to throw that back to Michael and Corey because, you know, they deal with that more than I do in the trenches.
Yeah. One thing I'll say about like PowerShell and stuff, honestly, like I don't have that much insight into, you know, what is working in a lot of environments these days with PowerShell or you know, we don't dig a ton into which tools are legitimately using it, because when we see our more advanced customers start blocking PowerShell and we start getting caught on things, we just start working that out of our TTPs for like red teams, where we just try and stick with the things that work the best, which one of them is the DLL hijacking thing that we've been talking about. Like, that's an excellent way to break the execution chain from what executed our initial foothold in the environment into, you know, what was our persistence mechanism and what we're going to do next. And yeah, we typically try and target those things that are, that we know are reaching out to the internet, and it makes sense that they are generating network traffic and all that stuff. And so we try and blend in as much as possible with whatever the legitimate stuff is that's happening.
Totally. And one thing to keep in mind as far as defenders go is, like, a lot of this, the fix is simple. The fix is probably just a directory permissions thing. I don't think it's really so much up to the program itself. I mean, the program itself is responsible, but from the perspective of the program, it doesn't know that it's being hijacked. It just, because when we hijack, we essentially, for anyone that doesn't know how it works, a program, when it loads, when it executes, it loads DLLs. The DLLs contain, you know, basically program functions that the program itself needs to use. When we do DLL proxying or DLL hijacking, which are kind of one and the same, we drop a malicious DLL into the same directory, and that malicious DLL proxies the legitimate DLL. So essentially, we're passing through the calls to the real DLL, and we're also injecting our malicious code into that chain. So essentially, that's how the attack works, and how to fix it is just don't let us drop our DLL into the directory that the system loads from. But there's a lot of, the reason a lot of these stick around forever is because programs load other programs. Like, for example, with Notepad++, it might be loading in like Windows netlib or something or whatever, win.http, and then that loads five other DLLs. So it's like, it's a kind of a parent-child inheritance chain of permissions. And if any of the things in that chain are vulnerable to directory read and write, then it's hijackable. So
I want to jump in and add one thing to what Corey just said, which is, like, one thing we are frequently taking advantage of right now is many users have the ability to install software themselves without being an administrator on the system. So this is like a feature of Microsoft App Store on a Windows machine, is that a regular unprivileged user can go on the App Store, on the Microsoft Store, and install applications. Those install in a folder inside the user's own profile folder on the computer with that user's permissions on them. That user owns them. So a lot of times we are DLL hijacking programs that user has access to modify because it was installed by that user. It's something common, like very common, like Notepad++ in this case. Locking down access to Microsoft Store, preventing users from installing third-party software themselves, is a big recommendation and something that organizations definitely can do and frequently doesn't break stuff.
There was a really good security article, and I've been looking for it this whole time, and it was based off of Palo Alto released all of their PowerShell scripts that they see via emails coming in, right, and the malicious PowerShell scripts. You can go to their GitHub and actually look at it, and it's in one big file, and someone did a bunch of statistics based on that and which commands that are abnormal, or like which variable is abnormal. So like IWR, right, is invoke web request. That may very probably never get used, but for some reason, threat actors are using it. I highly suggest checking that out. I wish I could find it. The other thing is ClearSpace is usually a pretty big factor in a lot of those commands, and try to tune based on that. That's been like a saving grace for me, but it's also, anytime you tune, you're poking another hole in your detection, so it's hard.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think it'll just be something that attackers evolve and defenders evolve along with them, just like everything else. Should probably move on. We're getting a little in the weeds on hacks.
I'm going to say, we got a lot of mileage out of the Notepad++ thing. Like, way more than I thought we would. Like,
Webcast? This is too technical.
I am really, really impressed with all of you, just giving that thing legs and running. I don't know. Do we want to talk about... Do we want to talk about North Korea, or do we want to talk about?
Yes, is I like BGP? North Korea. I didn't even read the article, but is it BGP? No,
I want to talk to
the North about Korea. Okay, one
let's
is
talk
interesting.
About it. Go for it. Who wants to talk about North Korea? Well,
I love seeing this kind of thing, and I think I'm on his side, 100%. I agree that Russia and North Korea are running crazy right now and doing what they're doing, and they're being left unchecked. Our government has teams set up to do cyber attacks for things, yet everything we do goes through our normal government bureaucracy and takes forever to do. This man single-handedly shut down North Korea's internet from his house.
It's not using,
but who has okay, explain there, how. Was it BGP? I need to know.
Definitely. It doesn't. I don't think it even explains.
It doesn't go into
it had to be BGP.
But here's as from like a threat intel standpoint, right? This guy releasing his name is
not good.
Not good, right? It is so dangerous. He just became Batman. Right. And now everyone knows who everyone knows. And then Batman's not even Bruce Wayne. Batman's really just like a middle aged guy in suburbia who doesn't have.
How do you know it's his real name? Did you OSINT this guy?
No. He's got pictures.
No, he's got. Yeah. He released his name. He releases his name.
Here's his name. Here's his name.
Even the government people he's working with told him, hey, your life is probably in danger now by the North Korean government, and you should probably arm yourself.
I think scroll up to like the first paragraph in the article, Ryan. There's something do like a control F for risk. It even okay no. Colombian American cybersecurity entrepreneur with hacker tattoos on both arms, unruly dark hair, and a high tolerance for risk. You have to have
also,
a high tolerance.
He's also
for
been
risk.
A presenter at DEF CON a number of times, so he's got a profile.
I don't know.
All right, all right. So here's the thing, and you know, I get that people like this. Okay, they're like, yay! I want you to think about it in a different way, right? Like people love these kind of stories, and that's great. And I'm gonna go with this guy's an idiot until I know otherwise. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt.
Come on the show if you're listening. Please come on the show.
Come on the show. Come on the show. But here's the problem, right? What people that like kind of push for this, well, we need to shut down the internet for Russia. We need to shut down the internet for North Korea. I've talked about it in the show in the past, where during the Gulf War, the internet stayed up 1 and 2 for a tremendous part of the actual offensive operations that we were doing. And the reason is because that we were getting intel. We are inside of their OODA loop. We are inside their comms. We are tracking where they're at. We're in their cell phone communications networks, tracking where all the people are. We're in their actual infrastructure so we can see communication profiles and find out where our targets are. The intel agencies are in and pulling intel about what their different operations are that they're currently working and that they're planning on working on in the future. So when you're talking about bringing down the internet, something like Russia, when you're talking about bringing it down for something like North Korea, you're actually talking about shutting down a monstrous amount of intel that the United States and other Five Eyes countries are collecting off of that country. So while it's awesome, right? It's really, really, really super cool that they can do this. Understand this, and this is absolutely important, as Corey was talking about, we can effing do it at any time we want. This is not special. This is not unique. He is not an effing snowflake. We just put out a BGP, we put out an ASN route, we've black holed. We can black hole like North Korea, super easy peasy, pumpkin squeezy, not a problem. If you don't believe me, look up BGP prefix attacks. Pakistan was able to bring down all of YouTube. We've had other countries that have been brought down. A good chunk of the internet was ran through Wyoming for some reason. So this is something that we always have this capability of doing. But we all need to understand that there is a double-edged sword associated with it, where if we shut that down, we lose those comms, we lose that intelligence. Many times we may lose our implants and the things that we have in place. And there is tremendous value in knowing what absolutely crazy people are doing. A case in point, if we look at Russia and we look at Moscow, we were in the comms whenever ISIS was ready to start an attack in Moscow. And we warned everybody. What is in Wyoming? That's the question. We were able to get inside of the comms in ISIS, in Russia, and warn people, not just American citizens, but everybody in Russia, hey, don't go out because this thing is going to happen. we need to keep those comms pipelines available for intelligence. So that's just another way of looking at it.
I think a lot of what our speculation would depend on what the actual technical details of the attack are. I think that, like, my take on this is, like, if U.S. government, if you're listening, just check your email and people won't do this anymore. Like, the reason the guy went public is because he feels that either he needs to raise awareness of the attack itself or show others how to do it. So he probably sent an email to the U.S. government saying, hey, I'd love to explain to you how to take down country's internet. And they just didn't respond. And he's like, all right, well, time for a blog.
He did. The whole article is basically, so Korea attacked him trying to steal his tool.
Punk Spider or which one?
Yeah, Punk Spider.
Back.
Yeah.
Oh, Punk Spider. He realized what was going on and he reached out to the FBI and said that the FBI, all they did was give him a basic field interview and no follow-up at all on it. So to him, that means they basically ignored him.
And yeah. So I go public. Yeah.
So he did the attack and then remained anonymous at first under the PAX identity.
Yeah.
And after that, the government reached out to him because he wasn't very, like, even the PAX thing, he wasn't very secretive about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
He had posted things right before he started using the name, basically saying he was going to do it. And then deleted them and popped up with the ID. So the government already knew who he was, and they started working with him.
When he released Punk Spider, DOD, I think, gave him money. Because for those of you that don't know, Punk Spider, like, you have Shodan, which is indexing services and the banners. Effing Punk Spider was actively looking for cross-site scripting, SQL injection. It was looking for real vulnerabilities, like scary, scary, cool stuff, amazing research. So hats off to him for that. So yeah, go ahead, continue. Yeah, I just wanted to make sure that people knew what Punk Spider was.
While he was still under the PAX name, he started presenting to the government and different branches of the government of how he did what he did and how the government could take more of a attack approach to things instead of always being defensive and taking forever to do things because they're throwing together these huge teams of people.
Mm-hmm.
After basically, the government was like, no, our bureaucracy doesn't allow for us to do things that way. He was like, well, then I'm just going public because people need to know this kind of thing is happening. And people need to know, in my opinion, I feel the government's dragging their feet about doing things about it. And the other thing, I agree with him on that. Like, I agree that shutting down their internet does have drawbacks to it. But at the same time, we don't seem to actively go after any of these threats either. We seem
I think it's a proof of concept.
We do. So, okay. So that's a lot to unpack. So, yes, the United States does. Whenever you're looking at the way that we do these types of operations, there are entire teams, of course, at the NSA and the CIA, that are taking offensive actions continuously against our adversaries. That is literally what they are doing all the time. Now, the problem with just calling up the FBI is the FBI is very fragmented, right? And I may be helping make his case. Like, if you just call up an FBI field office and you're like, hey, I got a bunch of vulnerabilities on North Korea. Unless you call, like, certain offices that actually do have a good cyber team, like, I know Los Angeles, Minneapolis, Hawaii, like, there's some out there that are just phenomenal. They have great teams. But other FBI agent offices don't. They don't have any clue at all. And calling or sending an email to FBI.gov doesn't really get you where you need to go.
What?
So actually knowing some people helps quite a bit. So it's always a little bit disconcerting when people are like, they need to be doing this. We are doing this. Like, we are actively doing this continuously. So sleep better or sleep worse at night, I guess, depending on your perspective. Now, is it done at the scale of, like, what China is doing to us? Not even effing close, not even remotely close. And that is something that a lot of people out there are having this conversation on about, you know, whenever we're looking at China and what they're doing, you start out hacking by hacking your own citizens. Then you move up the tier and you start hacking foreign businesses. Then you move up and you start attacking foreign governments. Then you work your way up to attacking DOD infrastructure right around the world. They have that. And they also have a crap ton of people doing it. And there was an article I think we talked about a couple of weeks ago where they have actual pen testing companies in China that are doing legit pen testing business and also doing that for the Chinese government as well. So whenever you're talking about a concept of scale, the United States government and NATO is nowhere near on the scale that China is. But, and I don't think, once again, you know, lots of respect to PAX and everything he did at Punk Spider was awesome, but this is not solving that problem. This isn't even appropriately calling attention to that problem, is kind of what I think is kind of
important. These people in China too, I don't think they're volunteering for the
conversation. Yeah.
I don't know. They were having frat boy parties, right? Like we saw. Yeah.
This isn't an all volunteer mission here.
It's all volunteer all the time. So
to bring it down to, I think, like the most simple explanation, I would guess that he already realized that he was the information's out there. North Korea knows, the U.S. government knows, so you might as well cash in on some of the street cred. That's my guess. That's my guess. Is like,
I like it.
He realized at some point he made an OPSEC fail that would expose exactly who he is, and so he figured, might as well get a DEFCON talk out.
This is like a Grand Theft Auto moment, though. He's at 3 stars now. I mean,
he was at 3 stars before. Now he just has. Now he has.
He added the fourth with this one. He's working on this.
Maybe, but come on, North Korea is going to figure out who you are. Like that. Like they're not going to be like, well, if he hadn't used a screen name, we could figure out who he was. Like, they're going to find you.
Our
like,
government figured it out in like a day. I'm sure North Korea wasn't far behind.
Yeah, like that's my guess. Out. He realized he used his real Gmail to log into itookdownnorthkorea.com.
All these servers resolved back to punkspider.org. I don't know.
Great domain. Short. Must be expensive.
That's my guess. And that's totally, that's based on no real information, but I'm just saying, looking at it from like the common sense perspective, might as well get a DEFCON talk out of it. If you're going to take on that risk, you might as well get something better.
Honestly, a DEFCON.
But honestly, let's have a bigger conversation about, like, if you go through the data that Punk Spider had and has, like the internet is effed. Like, it is.
Yeah, that's why we got to shut it down.
Vulnerable websites out there. We had a WordPress story that, you know, there's another critical WordPress vulnerability. And there's literally hundreds of thousands of WordPress sites that haven't seen a patch in the past 10 years, right? Like, that's, for me, that's a call to action. And that's what they're a lot of their research.
Can we talk about that just for a second? Because I just keep thinking about, not about WordPress, right? Not about WordPress specifically. Just about this idea and of like this whole ecosystem where we have just like a couple web site frameworks, right? That everyone builds their website from and they're all written in PHP?
I wouldn't say that. I would say only websites that have very, like, it's funny because I think the website, like, okay, someone tell me this. Name the largest company that uses WordPress for actual data. Because here's the thing. I've popped hundreds of these stupid WordPresses over the years. You get three people in there. You got admin, you got James from sales, and you got admin two. There's nothing in there. It's a completely meaningless, like it's a botnet. That's all it is. Like Facebook or LinkedIn aren't using WordPress.
What?
It's like all the data is in some extremely high-end database somewhere else. Hey. And then WordPress is like admin and sales too, and like three bloggers. You know what I mean? That's my perspective. Like,
okay.
They're all the companies using WordPress and not updating them are just like Tito's Tacos or whatever, and it's like a landing page from like 10 years ago.
But
it's
okay, like, here's my question. Here's my question for you, Corey. Do they need WordPress to have Tito's Taco page?
I'm going to tell you right Instagram, now right? why they WordPress is a thing. It is easy to host and easy just to set. No. As a data center, you can just set it up like, hey, you need a WordPress site? Boom, here you go. Hey. That's good. And it's cheap. That's why. I don't know how many times I've had to deal with shitty WordPress websites and they're like, my DNS isn't resolving. I'm like, oh my god, like here's the A record, here's a, like, there's, we used to get emails all the time that, hey, your IP address is attempting to hack us or attempting to do reflection attacks. Bam, it's a WordPress site on our shared hosting platform. It, that is why, because shared hosting is a thing and WordPress is easy to make money off of for for not,
I get it, I get it. I'm just people. Saying like, I guess what I'm saying is like, from my perspective, the meaningful parts of your net, exactly 0% are hosts on WordPress.
Yeah, no,
like,
that's a very,
it is literally, and I know, like, I think BHIS.com or Black, like, I think our website is WordPress. Yeah,
thanks, Corey. So
hold on. Get the machine gun
out. Here's the thing.
No one holds in us.
Here's the thing. We're talking about the non-maintained WordPresses. I think, honestly, what we need is like Punk Spider 2.0 that just patches them for you.
Well,
like that.
So Coder posted his LinkedIn post. And I think that all of a sudden this kind of makes a little bit more sense.
Yeah.
Because it's been a while since I started my role at Hyperion Gray as CEO, Hacker Offensive Security Lead Tester, but I wanted to share this update with anyone. I never left Hyperion Gray. It was my company, and despite an attempted partial sort of acquisition, long story, I've always continued to do what I love and believe. Recently, I was featured in Wired for bringing down a certain dictatorship's country's internet. Now he's being coy, right? And for bringing the internet down for over a week. I'm open to listen to anyone who wants to work for me or us. If you need nation state level capabilities, hit us up here. Our main interest is helping people that need true nation state hacker level capabilities on their side, whether that be for testing, simulated, or actual operations. So
wait, it's just a marketing?
It was a PR thing. And once again, I just want to call out, kudos to you, sir.
Who needs nation?
Kudos to you.
That is nation state level hackers, except for the government, other nations. You already talked to them.
My HOA needs it.
No. Wait. Okay,
hold on. They run their website on WordPress.
That is, dude. Hey. Props. That is amazing advertising, right? Like,
yeah, it is.
From this point on, anybody's like, do you have nation state level hacking capabilities?
Oh, it's like, I guarantee you, you can lower your cyber insurance with this one trick.
It's like, guys, I have nation state level hacking.
I ain't even mad anymore. I take back everything I said. I now know where he's coming from.
No. I have nation state level hacking. I do nothing for 2 years and then I say, I'm all out of ideas.
So, no, great marketing. Just chef's kiss. Well done. Nothing but kudos. I wanna kind of close out because this is the most important story. Because Larry Ellison had released an article. It said it's time to hand cybersecurity over
to computers. Yeah.
Doesn't he own like half of Hawaii or something?
Oh my God.
Like, doesn't he own like an entire island? I'm pretty sure he does. Anyway, sorry.
I you know what? Like, a lot of people have this hot take of AI and it's going to change everything in computer security. But does he even know that he's in charge of Oracle and they're one of the most they're huge pain in the ass company to do vulnerability disclosure with? In fact, they are so bad that we won't even communicate with them directly. So if we find a vulnerability on a customer's website that's using Oracle, we leave it up to the customer to disclose it to Oracle, because the last couple of times that we did it with them, we went back and forth over weeks just to get them to acknowledge that it was a vulnerability. And then when they did, it was like the vortex of free consulting. They were a horrible, horrible company to do vulnerability disclosure. Now, that may be better now, but it's just, they're awful. It's like, hey, you got a vulnerability in this product. And they're like, no, we don't. Yes, you do. No, we don't. Yes, you do. Here's a packet capture. No, we don't. You need to send us more details. Here's a packet capture with crayons pointing out exactly where the exploit is. That's not, it's horrible to work with them. So it's just like, how can he say that, you know, oh, well, all of a sudden we're going to have, you know, computers do better computer security.
How does Oracle even make money? I don't.
Whatever. Not just money.
Tech debt. They make money from tech debt.
Tech debt. Oh my
okay,
God.
But here's the. I will say, I don't trust hot takes from someone who's been married and divorced over 4 times. Like, just
like, I don't take advice from people who have a book that said the difference between me and God is God doesn't believe in me or something like that.
Like, that's if you've been okay, I'm not judging
the name of his effing book. Or okay, what, God doesn't. Whatever. I don't
want to judge, but I will say, if you've been married and divorced 4 times, you clearly are not a person who makes long-term decisions for the best. Like, like, so I'm just gonna go ahead and say, like, I don't think we need to be worried about this either. Long-term outlook. Yeah, like, yeah, he had probably had to give half of Hawaii up in alimony or
is
something.
Four the magic number? Is it three? What's
all right? Here we go. The name of the book is "The Difference Between God and Larry Ellison." God doesn't think he's Larry Ellison. That's his book. That's his book. Like, literally, he took a left turn at John McAfee, and you know he's so close, so close.
So what so does close, one Larry. Paragraph article say?
Wait, yeah, where's the article? I want a link. I want to.
I'm looking at it. It's like one paragraph. Well, okay, like 4, 5.
Yeah, he's talking about
you're definitely
worse than they ever had. Such vulnerabilities can be prevented by second generation autonomous cloud.
If we're handing off security, who are we handing it to?
Your cloud computer provider.
The computer.
Oracle Cloud. I see.
Yes. Oracle Cloud. We're gonna have.
By the way, that's where they make all their money. I looked it up.
But did he even take down any dictatorship's internet as part of this marketing?
Oh, you're right. You're right. This is advertising, Larry. Well done, sir. Well done. It's all advertising. Way to go. And effing cloud providers. Like, are you kidding me?
He's
like,
not the CISO of Oracle. He's only the CTO.
When you think cloud provider, no one really thinks of Oracle. Maybe it's like security through obscurity, right?
No, that's not true. The people
Andrew's
who think of Oracle.
We gotta get Andrew. He's been quiet. He's been lurking like a ninja in a battlefield, ready to strike. So Andrew, like, are we wrong? Like, do we need to hand all the security over to cloud providers? And if we choose one of them, should we choose Oracle?
I just want to rewind to that part where we're like, hey, the guy that denial of service North Korea's internet, maybe he shouldn't have provoked someone that has more money and resources.
Yeah.
With threats on his life. And I think that Oracle is probably in that territory. That said, they were doing really cool things. When OCI first launched, I remember they tried to differentiate themselves on hardware, and they had all this cool technology where as a consumer you could go in and you could like verify the hashes on the firmware, and you could like take over the JTAG pinouts of metal and racks, and that was how they were gonna do all their cool stuff. But yeah, we should not give cybersecurity over to the computers, especially the computers that are run by cloud service providers.
Because Andrew, I think we can't talk about it publicly, but we both worked with some of those cloud providers, and it's nothing but a bunch of engineers running around with their hair on fire all the time saying, I don't know how this works. I don't know what's going on. Isn't everything on fire? It's like, well, the sales are still flowing, so everything must be fine. Trust AI.
The people, and by the way, there are a group of people that when they think of cloud, they think of Oracle, and they're the people who are in sales, business, like, It's the dollars the dollars coming into the business that end up in Oracle.
So
this is a scary trend in business too these days, where businesses just want to look for a computer replacement for everybody. They don't want to have people anymore. They just want to let computers do everything for them.
Wait, Will, that's possible?
What?
Wait,
it is a tough one, right? Because, you know, whether you acknowledge it or not, those people that you are paying are probably using AI for some, like, to outsource their job, regardless of whatever policy you have.
You fire them and then you hire people that are willing to do the job. Then there's plenty of them out there right now. Holy crap.
I'm sure that, yeah, like, can you imagine being the responsible for Oracle's cloud security right now and being like, would you just tweet like in all caps, like, no.
yes, exactly.
Like he's basically saying, like, if you have Oracle and you get hacked, it's our fault. Like,
is there a product?
Hold on, I'm old. Hold on, I remember Oracle releasing their own Linux.
They do have Oracle Linux, and it is still in active production right now.
Oh,
it was based on CentOS, and it probably diverged when CentOS, you know, became Nye, and now it's just probably a Fedora variant.
Yeah.
They
do have their own Linux version, and it is still actively in production.
If you're I feel bad for like Mary Ann Davidson, the chief security officer at Oracle. She's probably just having a really tough week.
Yeah. I love this.
Being like emailing all the customers, being like, despite what Larry said, if you get hacked, it's not our fault. Okay.
I love this take. Loose and Shadow 85 said, joke's on you. Larry Ellison wrote the article with AI. So,
well, Andrew's kind of right though, because it's funny because they're like, oh, we'll have AI replace all these people's jobs. Well, the people who are doing these jobs are looking at using AI to accelerate their job. They're already using this to make their job more efficient, right? It's already a tool in the thing.
It should be. I mean,
you're letting yourself, you're like missing out on the whole thing, right?
But I, you know, whenever we talk about this for like pen testing and SOC and everything, I keep on pointing out that like you should be using AI in your job. Like you should be using it as a tool that assists you to be better at your job, right? I fundamentally believe that the jobs that AI is going to replace are going to be the shitty SOC analysts at the shitty companies and the bad pen testers and all those. If you're using it as a tool to improve what you do, Like, I go back. It's like, I remember when Google first came out. Like, people, like, schools freaked out. They're like, oh, my God, people can literally just Google and find answers.
Oh, my God, what were we doing?
I memorized all the state capitals for nothing. Damn it.
How we teach them to use the card catalog.
Exactly. We totally don't use Google at BHIS.
We totally don't. No.
What?
John, I'm going to take a different approach to this. I completely understand what you're saying and what Ralph was saying about using AI to add to your knowledge. But the thing that concerns me when we're talking about artificial intelligence is those people who aren't as tech savvy as those of us on the newscast or those of us in Discord. There are people who don't understand if and when the information that is being provided them was an automated decision or it came strictly from a machine or from a human. And in some cases, depending on what the training data is for a particular chatbot, it may be a poor automated decision. I certainly would not want an automated decision AI at 911. I would want a real life human being there. So I think these conversations are definitely more nuanced, especially when we're talking about people who are already scared about technology. And then we add artificial intelligence on top of it, and we just sort of blow up their world.
But that's what I'm talking about. We should look at it as a tool to enable us to make decisions. Because I would argue if somebody is going to allow AI to make a bad decision for them, odds are that's a person that would have made a bad decision without AI. Like if you're looking at 911, the conversations we're probably going to have at RSA in a few weeks, right?
You're not going to talk about AI there, John. Don't worry.
No, there's going to be no conversations of AI. It's just crypto and not part jokes. But whenever we're looking at it, I fundamentally believe that maybe it's going to allow people, quote unquote, dumb people to make decisions faster that are dumb decisions. And that's entirely possible. But everything that we've said, it's like, these are the same arguments against Google. These are the same arguments against Wikipedia. These are the same arguments against the TI-85 and TI-86. Yeah. This is the same argument against like calculators, right? So I think that, you know, quote unquote, uneducated, I don't want to call them dumb people, but less than optimally educated people are going to make bad decisions, whether or not they have AI supporting them or not. And I agree 110%, though. If you have entire organizations making decisions based on what AI is telling them without any critical thought, then it's starting to look a lot like the Foundation series at that point. So
Bronwyn had a really nice comment on the Discord channel. Essentially, the same people who are vulnerable to poor information are going to be vulnerable AI generated to poor info. Yeah. I didn't read that right.
But that is a good point, and that's the scary part about all the business people and the people in charge of businesses wanting to replace everybody with AI, is they just see that their employees are using this as a tool and not that, you know, the person in charge of running the tool needs to have the knowledge to do it correctly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, the best part is whatever company goes full send on this first is going to be the first to show everyone why it's a terrible idea. I'm ready to talk about it. It's going to be amazing. It's going to be like
since we're pulling out Bronwyn quotes, this is another one, just absolutely phenomenal. All AI is doing is strengthening the argument in favor of teaching critical thinking. Because so much of what we've been teaching has been rote memorization. Like, what are the 50 capitals? You know, what are all the countries in Europe? Like, we're teaching people that type of stuff because we're still teaching people in a way that they're going to sit down in a factory job and punch out widgets for 8 hours a day, right? If we continue to go down that path, AI is absolutely going to replace a bunch of people, right? But if we look at it as a tool to enable our critical thinking and allow us to parse additional information, I think it's going to be a wonderful thing. I don't think it's going to end up that way. I think the horrible thing is going to happen instead. But I think that point absolutely sums it up. We need to strengthen our ability as human beings to do critical thinking.
You know what I think is funny too?
Bullshit from truth.
Because I'm thinking about AI and one job that could replace, maybe a call center. Okay. So you call up to get technical support on something, but it's always something stupid and silly anyways, for the most part, right? Like the process already is kind of something that is very simple job, right? Usually the whole technical support process is oh, did you restart it? Oh, you didn't. We'll send you another one. So it's that level is not really that high anyways. So I can see them going for that. because, you know, they've already made this system that doesn't really require someone to like get deep into that.
As, so, I don't know. As like, as a, as on the blue team, right? That's, I feel like, fenced in via SOPs, right? Simple operating procedures, just instructions on how to do X and how to do Y. If Z happens, go over, do 1, 2, and 3. A lot of that, I feel like, can easily be automated. And a lot of that, like John said, is like that entry-level SOC analyst. Usually, if X happens, email Y person, wait for response, then do Z. And I think AI could take that over pretty.
At least not even AI. That's just power automated.
Right, right. We don't have critical thinking.
We don't have enough people in security that can handle it right now. And if we could have AI come in and assist with that, that would be amazing. That's not what they're trying to sell us, though. They're trying to sell us AI is going to completely replace all security people, right? We look at that like, good God, Pentera is a little bit better. They backed off the whole automated pen testing thing, but there's other companies out there. That artificial intelligence pen testing or artificial intelligence like Larry's talking about, talking out his ass, that we're just going to hand over all security to AI. That's bad. I think we can all universally agree that that's incredibly stupid. But if we can use it to help us make better decisions, maybe we have a chance at keeping up. And right now, we're not keeping up.
I do enjoy that this article points out specifically by name the Capital One breach, and then says, unfortunately, bank employees, humans misconfigured a system creating security vulnerabilities. Nearly all cyber attacks and data thefts begin the same way. If we actually look at the Cap One breach and we look at the most impactful breaches of the last 10 years, it was not that they had inadequate detections. It was that the majority of the time they did and nobody was looking at those.
Well, and I agree with you. The Capital One, like their take on the Capital One breach is so wrong. And I would also argue that AI would not have detected that. Simon, I think the guy's name was Simon. The other side,
Cap One was like really super low and slow over a long period of time. So you can't really argue that anomaly detection would have caught it.
But also Erratic, the hacker, she knew how that system worked. It wasn't like she was exploiting a zero day or anything. She was taking advantage of the design, like not the design, but the way that that system was implemented, kind of taking advantage of the reverse proxy capabilities to trigger those queries to come through. And it's entirely possible looking at it that AI would not have detected that as an attack.
I think we can also talk about how it was in a cloud service provider. It was a cloud service provider that got breached using some of the functions of the cloud. Like it was an IAM role, right? Like, I don't know. Anyway.
We could bring that up. That would be
the cloud is responsible for security. Okay, so let's go back in time and you have to pay for the Capital One breach. Does that sound good?
Larry asked ChatGPT what's the most hot article he could write, and this is what it said. Right, talk about AI and
come up with some executive hot takes for me.
Oracle's coming out with AI cloud security, yes. And they're going to be coming out in the next couple of months. So, once
absolutely
again,
don't buy it because it will open up firewall port for you.
If Oracle is, I reported enough Oracle
about news is not responsible for the views of the guests.
I know. And we definitely just stepped on some rich people's toes.
Who do I want to piss off less?
Yeah. Rule number one. Don't piss off the really rich because then you're
going to. All right. That's it, everybody. Let's kill the show. We're done. Thank you so much. Bring out the crooked finger.
Oh, boy.
God.